Chapter 29. "She's turning," Bettany said, when the fact of it could no longer be disputed. 20 minutes had passed since the first hint that Silver Wings of Morning might be altering her course. At first, we had read nothing into it, assuming only that the robots had made a small temporary course adjustment in response to the three ships zeroing in on her. The advantage in making such an adjustment was not at all obvious, but, since we could not begin to guess at the robot's tactical thinking, we had assumed that Purslane's ship would eventually resume its original heading, having gained some microscopic but quantifiable advantage over its pursuers. But she did not stop turning. During the course of those 20 minutes, Silverwings had altered her trajectory by 12 degrees, and there was no sign of her stopping. Machine space, the spray of exiled stars we called the Monoceros Ring, circumscribed an arc around the main disk of the Milky Way. Provided a ship can find its trajectory to a course parallel to the surface of that disk, it was bound to make machine space sooner or later, even if it took 100,000 years, rather than 10 or 20. But a ship would only have to steer a little off-parallel to guarantee missing the Monoceros Ring entirely. As Silverwings continued her course change, her projected destination slowly moved away from machine space. The course correction continued for another hour, until the ship fell back onto a straight vector. The change had cost the robots a little headway, but they would soon regain that advantage when we performed the same turn, as we were obliged to do if we wished to continue the chase. "Why did they wait until now?" Bettany asked. "They must have known which direction they wanted to head in when they left Naume. All this has done is cost them time."
"Our pursuit must have forced them to revise their plan," Henbane said.
"I don't think so," I replied. "I think they always knew exactly where they were going. They wanted us to think that they were returning to machine space, so that's the course they set when they departed orbit. They must have been intending to switch onto a different target as soon as they were out of observational range, when they were a year or two out from Naume. But they weren't counting on such a fast response from us. We launched the pursuit fleet after them so quickly that they realized there's no hope of completing that turn without us seeing it. So they've executed it now, before they reach high relativistic speed. It's difficult enough to turn a ship at 6/10 of light, but it's 10 times harder at 9/10 or faster."
"But if they're not heading back to machine space," Sorrel said.
"We have a hard fix on our course now," said Charlock, his imago glancing aside at a hovering readout. "Of course, she may still have a few changes up her sleeve, but if we take this as read, we can extrapolate out to 1,000 lights with an error of only a few thousand AU at the far end."
"Show us,"
Bettany said, his face still set in a rictus of total concentration. A map of the galaxy sprang into existence on Dalliance's displayer. The map zoomed in on our present position in the Scutum Crooks spiral arm, the scale enlarging until there was a visible gap between the bright constellated smudge of our ships and the silver circle of Naume. We were still technically inside its solar system, but would soon punch through the star's heliopause into true interstellar space, where only cinder-dark comets swam.
"Here's where we think she's heading," Charlock said as a red line pushed ahead of Silver Wings of Morning.
As the vector touched the edge of the box, the scale changed to encompass a greater volume of space.
"Nothing after 10 years, Charlock remarked. "Increasing to 100. No hit so far. She never comes within 2 years of a catalogued system."
The scale lurched again, until the box was 1,000 lights across, but still the red line sailed on without touching anything. Now it was thickening, as the cumulative error became visible.
"Close approach to a bachelor sun at 930 years, Charlock said doubtfully. "Maybe that's the target."
"No worlds, no rubble, no ice," Bettany said. "There's no reason for them to stop there."
Bachelor suns were stars that had their planetary systems ripped away by encounters with other stars early in their history. They were useless to all meta-civilizations, save as wormhole-tappable fuel sources.
"Increasing to 10,000 years, Charlock said. "Well outside the Scutum Crooks arm now. Error radius approaching 6 months.
After 7,000 years, she approaches within 15 years of the perimeter of the Harmonious Concordance, a mid-level empire of 1,700 settled systems."
"Could that be the target?"
asked Tansy, allowing for minor course adjustments. Universal actually predicts only a 50% likelihood that the Harmonious Concordance is still in existence, dropping to 11% by the time Silverwings would actually get there, Sorrel said, reading from his own displayer. That's an awfully long punt for something that has only a 1 in 9 chance of still being there. The UAE isn't always on the nail, Tansy said. But it's correct more often than it's wrong, Sorrel replied, and the Harmonious Concordance has all the right indicators for a textbook rise and fall. Unless they're counting on dealing with the shriveled remnants of a former empire, I can't see this being the target. I don't see it either, Bettany said. Increase the search volume, Charlock. We're already out to 10,000. Then we need to look further. Charlock shrugged, though his expression told us he no longer expected to gain much from this game. 50,000, he said, as the box swelled again. Error radius is now 2.5 years. Wide enough that we're going to be picking up systems all the way through. We're punching through a lot of galaxy here. You're going to have to trawl through several thousand candidates. List the systems in order of interception, Bettany said. We'll work through them one at a time. See if anything jumps out at us. In the meantime, keep refining our estimate of Silverwing's heading. We may be able to narrow that error radius a little. We're wasting our time, Henbane said. For all we know, she's going to turn in a completely different direction 30 minutes from now. Then we'll repeat the exercise, Bettany said, gruffly indifferent to the other shattering. They're headed somewhere. I'll sleep a lot easier when I know where it is. Or not, I said. I imagined Aconite standing before me. I had come to like him and would have been glad of his company now. I was alone aboard Dalliance, temporarily free of the other Imagos. There's something on my mind, I said, speaking a message that he would not hear until many hours from now, back on Naomi. It's going to sound insane, but I can't stop thinking about it, and I'm hoping it may have some bearing on Mazerian's interrogations. There was something about Seifel's body that wasn't right. I thought of Aconite scratching his beard and looking skeptical. What could possibly be right about a body that had fallen several kilometers onto a hard surface? She keeps coming to me, I said, in my dreams, telling me to pay attention. It's as if my subconscious has worked out what's wrong, but it hasn't yet managed to communicate that to my conscious mind. Now I'm hoping someone back on Naume can see what I'm missing. There are dozens of you, and you have the imagery the Emilians would have already recorded up to the moment of her death. Maybe there's something... I paused, aware of how absurd I might sound when my transmission was received. But I could not ignore Seifel, the urgency I heard in her voice when she admonished me for not paying attention. She had a long way to fall, Ack. What if she was alive all the way down, and she knew who had killed her? Could she have got a message to us? I ended my recording. It was several minutes more before I found the courage of my convictions and actually sent it. The turn had changed nothing as far as our immediate plans were concerned. Following our earlier discussion, the 3 uncrewed ships were running on independent parallel tracks to Silverwings, so that when they caught up with her, they could direct their energies into her sides rather than into the more vulnerable area of her stern. Seen in the display, the 3 ships formed an equilateral triangle, spaced 5 seconds apart. Silverwings lay at the apex of a tetrahedron, 10 seconds from any of the pursuing craft, but with that margin slowly decreasing. At 3 seconds, the ships would be able to target their weapons with sufficient accuracy to disable their prey without destroying it. What was clear, although not yet understood, was that the distance was closing quicker than expected. It was not that our ships were accelerating any harder than intended, for they had already been pushed to the limits of their engines, with all non-essential megatonnage ejected from their cargo holds. For some reason, Silverwings was not making as much headway as before she had executed her turn. Detailed analysis of her movements since leaving Naomi even revealed that the slowdown, more accurately, a barely measurable reduction in acceleration, had begun sooner than the turn. "They know we're behind them," Bettany said. "There's no reason in the world for them not to go as fast as they can. So what are they doing? Why aren't they pushing her as hard as she'll go?" "Maybe it's sabotage," Orash mused. "Could Perslane and Hesperus have got into the engine?" I nodded. Hesperus, perhaps. But if he was in a position to sabotage it... Bettany nodded. Why stop there? He'd go all the way, if he were able. Shut her down completely. They've got ships, I said, almost as the idea formed in my mind. A hold full of them, and most of them are still spaceworthy. We already know they made it into the White Ark. From what I remember, that ship had its guts stripped out and a parametric engine stuffed inside instead. Bettany gave a sharp little laugh. You think they may be running the Ark's motor, counteracting Silverwing's own engine? It's an idea. Purslane's not one to give up without a fight. Perhaps they couldn't get out of the bay, but they could still turn on some of those engines. Enough to flatten space around Silverwings, bring her to a dead stop? Probably not. Probably not even enough to take more than a few percent off her engine efficiency, and even then only if they get every operational ship up and running. I grinned, burning with sudden pride and admiration, for I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that this was exactly what Purslane had in mind. But that's what they'll be trying to do. Did Purslane sound as if she was ready to curl up and surrender? Not to me, Agrimony said. Me neither, and with Hesperus on her side. She never did give us an explanation of how he came back from the dead after all that time, Henbane said. She knew the other machines were listening in. Maybe there were things she had to keep from them. A sonorous chime interrupted our discussion, the signal that the three ships would soon be entering weapons range. Wordlessly, we turned our attention back to the display and waited for the seconds to drain by. Chapter 30. The wait had become almost unendurable, the conviction growing in me that Hesperus must have failed, when a quick blur of motion signaled his return. He nodded at me from beyond the outer door of the Ark's airlock, his image appearing on a panel to the right of the inner door. My hand moved to the ancient control that would grant him entry. "I am done, Purslane. You may open the door again." His voice buzzed from the panel. It was vacuum outside, but he was generating a radio signal from within his body. "Hesperus?" "It is me." I stilled my hand. He need not have said another word. I already had a bone-deep conviction that this was not him, but one of the other two robots. "I thought we agreed on a code phrase," I said, as fear pushed its chill hand into my flesh and ran a loving caress down my spine. "My memory is still not what it was." "You were fine when you left. You've been fine ever since you woke up from your coma." "Nonetheless, I am still experiencing problems. Would you be so good as to let me in?" "The code phrase." "I no longer remember it." The tall, broad figure, his coloration was still darkened for camouflage, spun his head around to look over his shoulder. It was a lizard-like movement, lacking any human quality. "I cannot be certain, but I think Cadence or Cascade may have achieved entry into the chamber. Time may now be of the essence, if you still desire my assistance." "Get away from the door. I don't know which one you are, but I know I'm not talking to Hesperus."
"You are mistaken, Purslane."
"I don't think so. There's an energy pistol in my hand. I just had the Maker dispense it for me. It's aimed straight at you, with the beam set for maximum dispersion." The densely packed weapon was cold in my fist, taking the burden of its own weight with the faint insect-like buzz of levators. "I can do it. Hesperus told me how to kill a machine person. Don't aim for any one spot, but spread the focus around, taking out as much function as possible. You may be holographic, but you're not indestructible." "If you were to discharge an energy weapon, you would damage the airlock, leading to fatal decompression." "Then it's a good job I'm wearing a spacesuit. That came out of the Maker as well." The figure took a step backwards, stiff as a knight in armor. It must have made a decision at that point, analyzed my voice and concluded that I was beyond persuasion, because I watched its profile shift, the metal skin creasing and stretching, tapering at the waist, broadening at the hips and chest, until I was looking at the elegant, ballerina-like form of Cadence. Her skin was still dark, rather than silvery, but in all other respects she had reverted to her normal appearance. "That was easy," I said. "I have killed Hesperus," she said, using her normal voice. "He will not be returning to help you now." My mind freewheeled. "Where did you kill him?"
In this chamber.
Not good enough. I want to know exactly where. Cadence cocked her head, looking away from the Ark.
By that ship, the green one with the retracted stasis foils.
It was one of the ships I had told Hesperus to visit, but she might just have been lucky in her guess, or seen him move on the cameras monitoring the bay. Bring me the body and we'll talk about it.
There is no body. I disintegrated him.
Cadence lifted up one arm, the armor of her sleeve folding open in a subtle, ingenious way, allowing a vicious assemblage of barrels and tubes to spring out.
Cascade and I have always been armed, from the moment we moved amongst you.
Then she let her arm fall in a stiff arc, mannequin-like, until the cluster of weapons was pointed directly at me.
Open the door, Perslane, before it is necessary for me to use force.
What's stopping you?
Clemency, a desire not to inflict further harm. We are machines, not butchers. We value life, even the tawdry approximation of life that is the organic.
You're still going to have to kill me if you want to get inside the Ark.
I would rather not have to do that. Can we not talk now? It was a brave and clever thing that you and Hesperus attempted to do. Despite our combined wisdom, we did not foresee that you would use these ships against us, to slow down Silver Wings of Morning. She is a lovely machine, incidentally, worthy of us.
I'm glad you like her. I'm planning on having her back.
That was always the arrangement, was it not?
Then Cadence angled her doll-like head again, the chamber's light flaring off the elegant ridge of her metal cheekbones and the luscious bee-stung swell of her steel lips.
I am puzzled, Perslane. You have a weapon capable of harming me, and you claim to be wearing a spacesuit. You have nothing to gain from my continued existence, yet you have not opened fire.
I thought I'd let you have your say first. My hand tightened around the weapon. The levators held it in place with such determined control that it felt as if I was holding a fixed support, like the knob of a banister.
I could ask you the same question. The Ark's engine is still running. Although this will have only a marginal impact on our chances of success, it would still be better if it was turned off.
So kill me and do it.
Cadence held up her hand and allowed the clustered weapon to fold itself back into her arm. You did not believe that I was capable of clemency, but I will prove it to you now. Deactivate the engine and we will come to an arrangement that guarantees your survival. I will give you time to consider this proposal.
My heart beat in my chest like a pulsar about to spin itself to pieces. I sensed that I was only one mistake, one ill-judged remark from instant death. I could not attack Cadence even if I wanted to. Despite what I had told her, I was not wearing a spacesuit. There had not been time for the Maker to produce one. It had been all I could do to make a weapon. I had to show that I was in control.
Get away from the ship. I won't shoot you because there'll still be Cascade, and for all I know, you two can make copies of yourselves. But you wanted Silver Wings for a reason, and whatever that is, it must be important to you. Hugely important, if you'd risk war with the entire human meta-civilization.
Cadence must have believed me, because she took several steps backwards.
You cannot stop us, she said. We are in control.
If you say so. The thing is, I'm not convinced you've any plans to keep me alive once we get to wherever we're going, which means that if I'm going to die anyway, and I'm reasonably sure that's the case, then I might as well get to do it on my terms, achieving something in the process. With a firmness that I had never heard in her voice before, Caden said,
Do not do this. It will not be in your best interests.
Got your attention. That's good. I had the impression of intense, feverish computation, the working out of a near-infinite spectrum of outcomes. If a machine could have sweated, Cadence would have.
We can still negotiate, she said. I will leave now and give you time to think things through. If you disengage the Ark, you may dictate arrangements for your survival. If they are acceptable to us, we will comply.
I had not been expecting this, but I tried to keep that to myself. What kind of arrangements?
You will bargain with the other humans on our behalf. You will persuade them to stop following us on the understanding that we will let you leave.
And I'm supposed to believe you'd follow through on that.
Cadence started to say something,
Another calm answer, her voice as beautiful and unruffled as it ever was. But she did not complete her sentence. What happened in the instant that followed was too fast for my eyes or mind to follow. All I could do was put it together afterwards, assembling the sequence of events from the broken fragments that had made it past the hopelessly constricted bottleneck of my animal senses. Hesperus had attacked Cadence, lacking a weapon, for there had not been time to mint one before he left the Ark. His only option had been to use stealth and surprise. This he had done with considerable success, for nothing in Cadence's reaction showed that she had any idea that Hesperus was creeping up on her in the shadows of the cargo bay. I recalled now how my first impression of him, when Campion walked him onto Dalliance's bridge, had been of the hunting cat I owned in Palatial, and the statue of David in the hallway of the family mansion. Those impressions, contradictory but complementary, came back to me with renewed force as he sprang onto the other robot, ramming her to the ground. The two dark forms wrestled, their movements so accelerated that all I could make out was a writhing dark mass, like a kind of quantum probability cloud made of metal. It all took place in the absolute silence of vacuum. Then there was a flash, bright enough to illuminate the entire chamber for a single dazzling moment, and then there were two robots again. They both lay very still. They were both broken. Hesperus was on his back, 5 or 6 meters from Cadence. There was a dark hole punched right through him, where his heart would have been had he been human. His skin flickered from dark to gold, gold to dark, and then stayed the way it was. Nothing moved behind the glass windows of his skull. Cadence was sprawled on her side facing Hesperus, for all the world as if she had just decided to lie down and take a nap. Her weapon arm had been severed at the elbow, wrenched away from the rest of her. It lay 3 or 4 meters beyond Hesperus. A squirming mass of silver machinery, oozing with mercurial unguents, erupted through her stump. Hesperus looked dead, but there was something alive in Cadence. Unable to leave the Ark, I could do nothing but watch. "Hesperus," I said into the door panel, "you've got to get up." Cadence stirred, but only minutely. Lights flickered in her head, and the fingers of her good arm twitched. The fingers of the severed arm, on the far side of Hesperus, also twitched. The angle of her head adjusted in stiff increments until she was looking at the severed arm. Her expression was fiercely serene. The silver machinery pushed itself further from her stump. It formed a tendril, a single bright filament, which oozed out until it touched the floor. The tendril kept growing, inching its way from the body. At first I thought she was going to reach for Hesperus and do something to him, administer the robot equivalent of a poison kiss, perhaps, but then I realized that the tendril was skirting around him, with the intention of reaching the severed arm. "Hesperus," I said again, "wake up, please." I wanted to shout, but the detached part of my mind told me there was no point. If he could not already hear me, nothing I could do would make any difference. The tendril completed its journey. Reaching the arm, it curled around it slowly, the way a vine might wrap around the fallen limb of a tree. Then it began to retract, slowly but steadily, dragging the weapon arm with it. "Hesperus, please," I said. Something got through. The lights flashed in his head once. The tendril had already dragged the arm a quarter of the distance back to Cadence. "She's still alive. Cadence is still alive." Squealing, garbled sounds exploded from the door. It was like 100 people shouting at the same time, in 100 different languages. If that was Hesperus trying to talk to me, something was very, very wrong with him. But then I already knew that. "Stand up," I said more forcefully now. "There isn't much time. You either stand up now or we're both dead. Listen to me, robot." He moved. It was a lazy yawn of his entire body. Then he was still again. "Cadence is putting herself back together," I said, "if you don't stop her." "Slain," he said, either attempting to pronounce my name or describing his predicament. "Move, golden boy, I need you here." He shifted again, the motion more coordinated this time. With a single convulsive spasm he rolled onto his side. He seemed to be looking directly at the other robot. The arm was scraping its way past the midline between them, half of its journey now complete. Hesperus lifted an arm, spread his fingers and placed his palm on the floor. He pushed against it and began to lever himself up, until he could get his other elbow under his torso for support. Then his legs twitched, and he began to ease himself into a position halfway between lying and sitting. The effort must have cost him, because for several seconds he was motionless. The arm now had only a few meters to go before it was reunited with Cadence. She must have been immobilized somehow, but as soon as she had the arm back, she would have a weapon she could aim and fire. Even as I was thinking that, consoling myself that at least she was paralyzed, Cadence twitched again and started to sit up. She was regaining mobility by the second, just as Hesperus had done. The robots had formidable powers of self-recovery.
"Hesperus!" I yelled, all logic now departed.
He broke out of his temporary stasis and climbed unsteadily to his feet. I could see the full extent of his damage now, a hole big enough to put a fist and an arm through, cutting right through him. The walls of the wound glistened with silver gore, bleeding mercury and strobing pulses of hard blue light. One of his legs was stiffer than the other. He turned awkwardly and surveyed the scene before him, Cadence and her severed arm, now only a meter from being reattached. He stepped across to her, walking like a man with one leg in a caliper. Cadence flinched back, raising her good arm as a shield. Hesperus planted his left foot on the silvery tendril. Still with great stiffness, he knelt down until he could reach the weapon arm with his right hand. He pulled it from the floor, the tendril stretching like hot cheese as he rose to his full height. His fist closed around the silver flesh of the severed arm, crimping it with appalling force. Then, with a single jerky motion, he flung the mangled arm into the darkness. I expected to hear it clatter in the distance, but of course no sound attended its impact.
"Hesperus," I said, "can you hear me?"
He said nothing, but took another step closer to the other robot. He kicked her until she rolled onto her back, then lowered his left foot onto her abdomen. Beneath him, Cadence thrashed with increasing strength. Hesperus lowered himself slowly until he was kneeling on her. Then he reached out with both hands and took a firm hold of her remaining arm. His shoulders moved with massive gorilla-like effort, and the arm came loose. He flung it aside, but with an almost disdainful effort, so that it came to rest only a few meters away. Then he swung around, adjusting his hold on her until he faced her legs, and took them off, piece by piece. All the while Cadence squirmed and convulsed, but her efforts achieved nothing. In a short while, Hesperus had dismembered the other robot completely, leaving only her head still attached to her torso. He stood up, clutching Cadence's palsying remains to his chest. Still stiff in one leg, he made his way to the door. My heart racing, the energy pistol still gripped in my hand, I allowed him into the lock. Air cycled in. The inner door opened and Hesperus almost fell out, dragging the head and torso behind him. His movements were still very sluggish and uncoordinated. The air smelled of burned metal, and there was a hissing, fizzing sound coming from his open wound.
"I am damaged," he said quite clearly.
"Take this," I said, offering him the energy pistol. "You can finish her off."
"I don't want to finish her off. She can still be of use to us."
The discrepancy between the calmness of his voice and the shuffling, punctured figure before me was unsettling. It was like having a corpse talk back to me. "Are you going to be all right?"
"I can repair myself, given time. Help me to the bridge. We will be safer there."
With Hesperus still cradling the other robot, leaning as much of his weight against me as I could bear, we shuffled our awkward way through the arc until we reached the white womb of the control center. All was as we had left it. "I should contact Campion."
"That can wait. Find me Aspic of Machines."
"What kind?"
"Any kind. It doesn't matter."
He let the torso clatter to his feet. Cadence was still watching his every move, like a viper looking for its chance to strike.
"He is lying," she said,
her own voice just as unchanged. "The damage he has suffered is not repairable. He is in the process of terminal system shutdown." I waved the energy pistol at her. We could just kill her now.
The aspic, please?
Hesperus extended a trembling hand and took the weapon from me at last.
I will keep watch on her. Find Synchromesh for yourself.
Why Synchromesh?
Just find it.
It was the first time I had heard irritation in his voice. The human part of him must have been pulling the strings. In an adjoining chamber, I found several tubes of multi-purpose aspic of machines. I was already carrying an eyedropper of Synchromesh. I returned to the command room to find Hesperus still keeping guard on the twitching silver torso.
What about the bits of her you left outside? They can't hurt us now. They'll attempt to reconvene, but provided her head and torso remain here, that won't happen.
He passed me back the energy pistol and took the tubes of aspic.
As I said, I am damaged, but I can repair myself, given an infusion of raw materials.
He took one of the tubes and squeezed a dollop of quivering black aspic into his palm. The material organized itself into various geometric shapes, indicating its readiness.
Will that work with you?
I knelt down, my back against the wall, resting on my haunches with the energy pistol aimed at Cadence.
It's human machinery. I didn't think it had anything to do with the stuff inside you. It doesn't.
His mask formed an exhausted smile.
But it can be made to. It's very simple, really.
He smeared the black dollop into his wound, caking it around the silvery lining of the tunnel Cascade had blasted through him. As he did so, Hesperus made an involuntary sound, a kind of synthetic howl, like a radio picking up too many channels at the same time.
I am not in pain,
he said, when the moment had passed.
But there is confusion. The aspic will help me repair myself, but it will take time.
He squeezed another mound into his palm and applied it to the wound, over the material he had already administered. Now he convulsed, as if a bolt of electricity had just surged through him.
Hesperus? Keep your eye on Cascade.
He spread more of the black paste into his chest.
I must enter a state of reduced consciousness while these repairs are effected. I may be incommunicado for several hours, possibly longer.
I'm worried. She's a robot, Hesperus. I've already seen how fast you can move.
She can't do anything quickly now. It will be safe to use the synchromesh on a low ratio.
I don't like this.
I don't like it either, but I'm useless to us both unless I can heal myself.
He pushed a final dollop of machinery into his wound, which now resembled a steep-sided black crater more than a tunnel, and slumped back against the wall. Then his lights flickered once and died completely. I could only trust that somewhere inside that golden body something was still alive, putting itself right.
Go ahead, Cadence said sweetly. Use the synchromesh. I promise I won't try anything.
That was when the arc started shaking, the vibration nearly knocking me off my feet. Chapter 31. Charlock's ship was the first to move within attack range of Silver Wings of Morning. With light minutes of communications lag between Dalliance and the three ships of the lead squadron, there was nothing to do but gather around the holographic volume and watch the playing out of a series of events that had already unfolded. Powerless as we were to change the outcome, we still felt as if it should be possible to reach into the blue-gridded space and move the pieces around, as if they were no more than icons in a game of strategy. My mind veered between the conviction that this was the only course of action open to us and the bitter certainty that I was about to play spectator to the death of my lover and closest friend, fully complicit in the decision to kill her.
You don't have to watch any of this, Bettany said. Go and wait somewhere else. We'll let you know when it's over.
I'll sit it out if that's all right with you.
Of course, as long as you understand that none of us would have held it against you.
Orish's imago reached to touch her non-existent hand against mine.
This is difficult for all of us. She's our sister, but I can't imagine what you're going through.
Pastlane can take care of herself, I said, but the words rang hollow, as if I was the one who needed convincing.
Silver Wings is strobing her impasse, Charlock said. Pseudo-thrust is falling, as we'd expect.
Strobing gave Silver Wings a measure of defense, but there were gaps in that armor, spaces between the time-phased ribs through which a well-aimed rapier might slip. Charlock's ship was Steel Breeze. In the battle volume it was a blunt-tipped yellow arrow closing on Silverwings, narrowing the distance from tens of thousands to mere thousands of kilometers. "She's phasing her weapons," he said, eyeing the banner of icons and numbers accompanying his ship, sinking her gamma cannon to punch through Purslane's impasse. He turned to face us with pride in his expression. "She's learned well. It's exactly what I'd do if I was there, controlling her in real time." "A broadside hit," Agrimony announced, as the numbers tagging Silverwings changed abruptly. "Significant hull ablation and ionization. I think you got through, Charlock." He grinned. "Gamma cannon cycling for another discharge. Holding sync lock with the impasse. Firing. Secondary ionization focus 3 kilometers astern of the first. 2 palpable hits." Agrimony looked excitedly at the rest of us, raising a clenched fist. "We're getting through. She's not putting up any kind of defense. The robots obviously don't have sufficient control." "Don't count on it," I said under my breath. Steel Breeze might have punched a couple of craters in Silverwing's hull, but the numbers next to her revealed no drop in acceleration or impasse effectiveness compared to before the assault. "Cannon cycling," Charlock said, "maintaining sync lock, retargeting on drive epicenter, firing." After a few seconds, Agrimony said, "Zero ablation, no damage beyond the first 2 impact sites." "She must have shifted to a different field phase," Bettany said. "Compensate and adjust." "Give her time," Charlock said. "She's dealt with this kind of thing before. It'll just take her a few moments to assemble a predictive model for the phase and frequency shifts, then she'll be able to punch through again. Gamma cannon recharging. Firing." "No change in damage status," Bettany said. "She must be phasing faster than you can sync lock." "Give her time. She just needs to refine her model." But when Steel Breeze fired again, there was still no sign that she had found a way through to Silverwing's hull. The impasse soaked up the gamma rays effortlessly, using some of that energy for its own purposes and re-radiating the rest to space in a long simmering cymbal crash of downshifted X-rays. I tightened my handhold as an acceleration surge washed over me. "We should move the other ships in. One might not be able to cut through, but if they all run different phases and frequencies, Silverwings might not be able to block them all at the same time." "That's not the strategy we agreed on," said Sorrel. "The one we agreed on isn't working. All it's doing is slowing Silverwings by a tiny amount. Time we move to a new script before we play ourselves out." Bettany wavered for a moment, then nodded. "Orash, Agrimony, instruct your ships to move into immediate attack range. Coordinate with Steel Breeze to find a gap in her coverage." With the ship still 3 minutes ahead of us, it would take that long for the new battle plan to reach them, and just as long again before we saw the results of our change of approach. Until then, all we could do was watch Charlock's ship continue its engagement. Steel Breeze attempted another 2 discharges from her gamma cannon, then spun around, strobed her impasse and applied pseudo-thrust. "She's not retreating," Charlock said, as if that was ever in our minds. "She's clever. She's realized that she can't get through that way. Now she'll do exactly what I'd do in the circumstances. Switch to lampreys." "How many are you carrying?" I asked. 52. Mid-range gamma cannons and high hysteresis gain drives. Let's see how Silverwings deals with those, shall we?" "Don't count your chickens," I murmured. Lampreys were fast and agile, but they could never compare with the potency of a ship-mounted weapon, nor did they have the ability to adjust beam properties to deal with a rapidly strobing and phase-shifting impasse. In the battle volume, the lampreys were a spray of yellow dandelion seed erupting from Steel Breeze. They split into 2 formations, 12 forming a cordon around Charlock's ship, the other 40 diving for the much larger target of Silverwings. With their skein drives applying pseudo-thrust, the lampreys could push against Steel Breeze's field boundary, enabling her to hold her position relative to Silverwings, even while maintaining full impasse. That was the one trick Purslane's ship could not emulate. It would have taken thousands of lampreys to overcome the mountainous inertia of Silverwings, and I knew she did not carry that many. The 40 attacking lampreys broke into sub-squadrons, and began concentrating their fire on the areas of vulnerability we had already identified. Occasionally, one managed to punch through the strobing field, but I knew that it was more by luck than judgment, and even when the gamma rays touched naked hull, they did no more than scuff against that armor. But perhaps it could work, given time, the death of 1,000 cuts, rather than a single decisive wound. I allowed myself a flicker of encouragement from the fact that Silverwings had yet to respond in kind. Perhaps the robots really were struggling to control all her systems. 6 minutes after the transmission of the new battle orders, Orash and Agrimony's ships, Mystery Wind and Yellow Jester, moved into attack range, strobing their fields and coordinating the use of their shipboard gamma cannons with Steel Breeze. The Lampreys continued their needling assault. The new ships dropped impasse long enough to release Lampreys of their own. Cannons loosed.
Impact! Shouted Agrimony. Ablation and ionization, kilotons of hull plating, we're getting through.
Impasse or instability, Henbane said, catching some of Agrimony's excitement. By God, she's hurting. Field dropped to zero for 2.8 milliseconds. 4 lampreys now inside Silverwing's impasse. Field drop again. Make that 9 lampreys. Moving to firing positions. We're inside the moat.
Main cannon cycling, Charlock said. One clean hit is all we need. I'm starting to think we can actually do this.
Then he stopped talking. The blunt arrow that was the icon for Steel Breeze was flashing on and off, signaling something catastrophic. The banner of numbers and symbols next to the pulsing icon updated rapidly. Our attention flicked to the real-time image of his ship, captured from the other two vehicles. They were looking through the battle volume, hazed by savage energies, the intervening space roiled by impassor and drive distortion, awash with gas and debris. But even an imperfect view was enough to tell us that something was very wrong with Steel Breeze. Charlock's ship was pulsing with miniature explosions, ripping along the raked edge of her flanks like a spectacularly choreographed fireworks display. The Arrowhead craft began to tumble, the sequenced pink stutter of real thrust engines signifying desperate attempts to regain lateral control. It was to no avail. Somewhere inside, the inertia-compensating machinery lost its hold on the ship. As several hundred brute gravities sank their teeth into the fabric of her hull, she tore open like a carcass. An instant later came the fierce light of her dying engine, a growing white sphere, dulling to purple, and then black along its perfect boundary. The sphere swelled to the size of the impasse quicker than the eye could track. For a delirious moment, the impasse held it in check. Even though the impassor that had woven that field was now no more than a cloud of fundamental particles at the heart of the explosion. The sphere turned a more furious kind of white, a white that burned into the eye like a hot lance, dappled with the negative specks of the lampreys still gathered around it, and then broke through that final, failing barricade into open space. Steel Breeze was gone.
"What just happened?" Charlock said, looking around like a man who needed someone to shake him out of a bad dream. "Someone tell me what just happened. We were winning. We were getting through. Why did she start fighting back now?"
"She was biding her time," Tansy said, "waiting until all 3 ships were close. Must have punched through her own impasse with a sink-locked gamma cannon."
"Pull Mystery Wind and Yellow Gesture out of attack range," Bettany said, clutching onto his calm facade, as if it was the last firm thing in the universe. "And then hope and pray that they work it out for themselves, because I don't think Silverwings is going to sit and wait for us to make the next move."
Chapter 32. I reached out a hand to steady myself, the other grasping the fixed handhold of the energy pistol with renewed strength. The weapon wavered and recentered itself on Cadence. There was another vibration, harder and sharper this time. Chimes began to sound from the white control core, emergency messages scrolling in cryptic red text across its surfaces.
"What's happening?" I asked.
"Work it out for yourself."
"It sounds to me as if we're under attack. Maybe Cascade is trying to break into the Ark. But I don't think that's it. If he was going to use force against us, he'd have done it already."
Cadence regarded me levelly but said nothing.
"The whole ship must be under attack. Silverwings herself. Those were either weapon impacts being soaked up by the impasse, or her own weapons discharging, or both."
Cadence tilted her head minutely. "An attack is in progress," she informed me, her tone neutral.
How many ships?
3 of your pursuit craft. I give you this information freely, since it is valueless. I raised myself from my haunches, still keeping the energy pistol aimed at her, and made my way to the command console. Recalling the sequence of commands Hesperus had already shown me, I activated the Ark's transmitter.
This is Purslane. I'm still here. Would someone like to tell me what's going on?
I waited the requisite 5 or 6 minutes, but no reply was forthcoming.
They cannot hear you now, Cadence said. With the impasse raised to battle strength, only Silverwings herself could get a coherent signal through. This Ark does not have the power to reach your friends, nor the sensitivity to detect their return transmissions. You can't run at battle strength forever, though. You're losing headway all the time you aren't on drive. That means you consider these ships at least a plausible threat.
They have weapons. They could destroy us if we do not take precautions. This is hardly a startling admission.
There was another vibration, lasting 30 or 40 seconds. Despite the many layers of field damping between the Ark and the outer boundary of Silverwing's impasse, it still felt like a small earthquake. I felt a stomach-churning surge as the engine snatched and grabbed, trying to maintain headway in the instants when the impasse was recycling.
"You're doing an awfully good job of keeping me alive," I said. "If I was a couple of robots running a ship, I wouldn't bother going to all that trouble to neutralize acceleration, especially in a battle situation. I'd just be thinking about my immediate survival."
"You are our hostage. If your continued existence enables us to negotiate with our pursuers, then you are of use to us."
"Then they are a concern, or you've got another reason for keeping me alive."
"They inconvenience us. They irritate us. No more than that."
Trusting nothing Caden said to me, I considered it worthwhile trying to signal Campion again. Again, there was no sign that my message had got through. My attention wavered for a few moments, fixated on the unfamiliar technology. When I snapped back onto her, Cadence had begun to push a glistening chrome tendril from one of her leg sockets. I shot it. Naughty. The energy discharge had singed the remaining part of her leg back from the stump, turning it from chrome to charred black. Cadence appeared oblivious to the damage I had just inflicted.
"You must understand that I will do what needs to be done," she said, as ruthlessly calm as ever.
"That makes 2 of us, then."
"Cascade informs me that 2 of the 3 ships have now been disposed of. The 3rd is damaged and yet still attempting another assault. It may be that their aim is poor, or that they have simply abandoned any hope of saving you."
Cadence's tone became patronizing. "Of course you feel betrayed. You have every right. How else are you expected to feel, having been deemed expendable?"
I said nothing. Arguing with that implacable silver face was beginning to bore me. The vibrations increased in ferocity over the next 10 or 12 minutes, reached a peak and then ended without warning. I waited, expecting them to return, but as the minutes wore on it began to seem as if the attack was over.
"That's the last ship gone," Cadence said.
3 of your fellow Shatterlings dead, and to no avail. I believe the ships in question were Steel Breeze, Yellow Jester, and Mystery Wind. Doubtless you can tell me who was aboard them."
"Our ships don't need us aboard."
"Yes, cling to that possibility."
After a moment she added, "What I said to you earlier, before we were interrupted. The offer still stands, Purslane. Negotiate with your friends. Tell them to give up their pursuit and we will still let you leave."
"And Hesperus?"
"Take him if you wish. No matter what he told you, he is damaged beyond effective repair."
"You're not looking too good yourself. Aren't you upset that Cascade hasn't come down to try and rescue you?"
"He knows I pose no risk to the success of this mission. I cannot be coerced or manipulated. I cannot be tortured or deceived. If I imagined there was the slightest danger of you learning something of tactical value, I would destroy myself. If Cascade felt the same way, he could reach into me and kill me himself."
"Where are we headed?"
"You'll find out when we get there."
"Hesperus already looked inside you when he was damaged and you were trying to see what he knew. Isn't that a concern?"
"He saw very little. He is even weaker now, and we have modified our protocols to block the one channel he was able to penetrate. It was an oversight, an unacceptable one,
but no great damage was done. We still have the ship, which was always our objective.
My ship.
You've done well with her. She is very fast.
Is that all it is, Cadence? Is that all this is about?
She cocked her head. What else could it be? Speed is of the essence. Your ship is unquestionably fast.
End of story.
Yes.
It seems to me that you came a long, long way just to find a very fast ship. Hesperus and I don't think you learned very much when you were on Niume. I shifted to a more comfortable position, resigned to the fact that this was going to be a long wait. There had been no change in Hesperus since his lights had gone out, nothing to indicate he was ever coming back to life.
Did you kill Syphel? I asked. You can tell me now. It's not going to make a difference to our relationship.
Then why ask?
Old-fashioned curiosity.
Then yes, we killed Syphel.
By throwing her off a balcony?
Sorry, but that doesn't strike me as quite your style.
I've seen how quickly you can move, how you can change form and color when you need to. I can't help thinking you'd have preferred to kill her some other less clumsy way.
It would have been a mistake to assassinate her in a way that identified us as the culprits.
No, you didn't do, Syphel. That was someone else. Her death might have suited you. It might have put us off the immediate trail of solving the mystery of the ambush, but it wasn't you. And you didn't want me to know that, did you?
Something quickened behind her eyes. Alarm or interest, I could not say for certain.
What you know, what you do not know, is of no concern to me.
I know why we were ambushed. It was to prevent the emergence of information damaging to the commonality. If a handful of us hadn't been late, it would have been all over for Gentian Line. The secret that we were about to reveal to the wider galaxy would have stayed a secret, but no one allowed for you.
Then the ambushers were acting in the interests of humans, Cadence said with an amused tone. From your standpoint, they were doing the right and proper thing. Far from hating them, far from seeking to bring them to justice, you should applaud their efforts. If you care about your species, you should do all in your power to complete the work the ambushers began. Tell your friends to turn their ships around, return to Niume, and concentrate their weapons on any remaining Gentian shatterlings, then turn that fire on themselves until none are left. As a final grace note, you could be the last to commit suicide, the last to take that secret to her grave. Would that not be a reasonable course of action, Perslane? Would that not be the decent thing to do?
It might if you didn't already know about the ambush and the reasons for it.
Well, there is that.
I tipped the synchromesh into my eyes, one cold, clear drop into each. You didn't come to suppress the emergence of that knowledge. Something else brought you to Niume, and I don't think it was my ship either.
Why else?
That's what I'd like to know. That's what I'm going to find out one way or another.
And then?
I'll stop you. There are a million ways to do it.
Almost all of which happen to involve your death.
But like you say, that would be the decent thing to do. I'm not above a grand gesture if I think it'll serve a higher good. It just may not be your higher good we're talking about. I lifted my sleeve and adjusted the dial on my chronometer.
Chapter 33. Charlock might have lost his prize Steel Breeze, but he still had enough grip on events to remember the search he had been running before the failed attack. There was only a slight waver in his voice as his imago spoke, addressing us all.
The battle didn't change a damn thing. Silverwings varied her course during the initial assault, but as soon as it was over, as soon as we lost Mystery Wind and Yellow Jester, she fell back on exactly the same vector she was following before. The course projections I showed you earlier are still valid. She'll still skirt the harmonious concordance in 7,000 years, passing within 15 years of the present boundary. I think we agreed that that isn't likely to be the destination.
Further out? Bettany asked. I asked you to look out to 50,000 years.
I did. Here are the candidate systems in order of interception.
He raised his hand to an offstage displayer.
Dalliant showed the same list. It kept scrolling, line after line. Coordinates, commonality name for the primary and for the major planet or moon with which the system was most likely to be associated, a string of code numbers identifying surface conditions,
metallicities, host civilizations, or the absence thereof. It was a long, bewildering list, hundreds of possible solar systems. Until Charlock had produced it, I had imagined it would be a relatively simple business to scan through it until something jumped out at us. I had even wondered if the target might turn out to be one of the systems under investigation by the Vigilance, but none of those were showing up.
"She passes through each of these systems," Orash said, calmer now, the loss of her ship absorbed, if not forgotten.
"Maybe not, but while we're still uncertain of her trajectory, we can't rule any of them out." Charlock's brow was glossy with perspiration. He dabbed at it ineffectually, drying his fingers on his sleeve. There are hundreds of worlds where Gentian line or another line of the commonality has had some kind of business before, but that would apply no matter which direction we looked, and none of the systems on this list are of any obvious significance.
"Any prior involvement?" I asked.
"Nothing. I searched for relic sites, but nothing came up." Agrimony scratched at the skin under his collar. "What about cultures that have had dealings with the machine people? There must be some in that list."
"A handful," Charlock said, "but according to the UA, they've next to no chance of still being there."
"How many candidates in total?" Bettany asked.
348. Of course, limiting the search sweep to 50 kilo-years was an entirely arbitrary decision. If I look further out, or allow for an additional degree of uncertainty in our projection of Purslane's vector, we'll start picking up thousands. That's before we factor in stellar proper motion, galactic rotation, and the degree to which the robots are allowing the gravitational field to bend their trajectory.
"There are 9 of us," I said. "We could at least break that list down into manageable chunks and see if we find anything that way. We should send it back to Niumi as well."
"I've done that already," Charlock said. "But we're getting fast now, and it's going to take a while for any return signals to catch up with us. Before we dice the list into pieces, though, I think there's something you all ought to know."
Bettany crossed his arms.
"You found something?"
"Not in this list, but for the sake of my own curiosity, I extended the search volume a little further, just in case we were missing something obvious."
I sensed Bettany's patience hanging by a thread.
"And?"
"There's something at 62,000 lights, way across the plane of the galaxy. Quite honestly, I don't know what to make of it. But if we take the numbers at face value, it's a very high confidence hit. She's aimed directly at it."
"At what?" I asked.
"One of our star dams," Charlock said.
Gallingale reported in a little while later. I was outside the summer house in Dalliance's gardens, making a vain effort to clear my head with some fresh air in my lungs and blue skies above me. I had told the statues to stop moving around. Their slow, dreamlike enactments were too distracting. I wanted absolute stillness outside my skull, in contrast to the whirlwind of thoughts and emotions going on inside it.
"I'm still prepared to have a crack at this," Gallingale's imago said, rendered with gauzy indistinction halfway up the gently sloping meadow. The others gathered around him in more solid invocations.
"Not after what we've just been through," Bettany said. "We've lost 3 ships. I don't want to lose another ship and a good shatterling. It was a courageous offer, Gallingale, but it was made before we had a real appreciation of what we're up against. Throwing another ship at Silverwings, no matter how well-intentioned the gesture, won't achieve anything."
"I feel that way as well," I said. "Steel Breeze and the other ships weren't badly equipped, and nothing they did was obviously stupid. We're just dealing with a stronger adversary, with the rapidly improving control of Purslane's ship."
Gallingale's response arrived 2 minutes later. "All the more reason to strike now, before that control gets any better."
There was more determination in his voice than I had been expecting. "Besides, we can change our strategy now."
I had my hands on my hips.
"Can we? Nothing's changed as far as I'm aware."
"No one's going to see it, so it may as well be me. It's been a while, Campion."
Gallingale looked around at the others.
"We haven't heard from Purslane for a whole day. Her silence began before the battle, so it can't just be the difficulty of getting a signal through the impasse. We should have heard from her since. We know our attack didn't come close to doing any real damage to Silverwings."
"Then she's still alive."
"And not talking?"
Gallingale was staring at me with genuine sympathy.
She'd have been in touch, Campion, unless the robots found a way to get to her. She was safe. She was secure in the Ark, but we both knew the robots weren't going to let her stay there unchallenged, especially if she started getting on their nerves. He raised his hand suddenly, anticipating my response. I'm not saying she's dead. I'm just saying we have to consider it as a possibility, whereas before it was a stone certainty that she was still alive. Now we don't have the luxury of that knowledge. I do. For the sake of argument, how does this change things? Bettany asked. Our ships expose themselves to broadside attack. That's not a risk we ought to take again. With lateral-mounted gamma cannons, we have the tactical advantage in a stern chase. Our ships are designed to shoot forward, not behind. There was no need to discuss the case of Silverwings. Galingale was correct in all respects, and every one of us knew it. When you already have some of the fastest ships in the galaxy, defending against pursuers is seldom the highest priority. That did not mean our ships were powerless against a chasing adversary, but the most effective weapons, the ones that were too large or cumbersome to steer, were normally optimized for forward attack. "She'll still have an impasse raised as soon as you enter weapons range," Charlock said. "What makes you think you'll get through it any easier than our ships did?" "I'm not seeing I will, but at least I won't be trying to hit a specific target or avoid hitting sensitive areas. I can just concentrate my fire wherever I sense the greatest weakness in the impasse or the underlying hull. Now we know that the Stardam is her objective. Stopping that ship, destroying her if necessary, has become more important than just slowing her." He was glossing over the uncertainties regarding the destination, the possibility that it might not be the Stardam, but I was ready to let that slide for now. "Without an opener, they won't achieve anything," I said. "And you'd stake the reputation of the line and the future stability of several human civilizations on that assumption. Sorry, Campion, but we can't trust Lady Luck any more. Lately, she's taken to pissing on us from a great height." "I won't sanction it," Bettany said. "Not while we know Purslane's still alive. She may come through with a transmission at any moment. We can't guess the conditions she's under." I allowed myself a moment's relief. "But it'll take a while for Midnight Queen to reach attack position, won't it?" Bettany went on. "If I put myself into abeyance and disengage all safeguards, I can be within attack range in 30 hours. Unless Silverwings slows down, no other ship has the capability to cross that gap." Bettany began to turn away. "Do it. You have line authority." "What?" I started to say. Bettany silenced me. "He keeps a channel open the whole while. He doesn't get authorization to attack until we've reviewed the data again, when he's nearly in range. That's 30 hours, Campion. If we haven't heard from Purslane by then, I think even you would have to admit..." But that was as much as he could bring himself to say. "I swear I won't attack unless we know she's beyond all hope," Galingale said. "Now excuse me, if you will. I need to make some arrangements." His imago buzzed with static and vanished from the garden.